It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Our family is happy to be part of this statistic. More than 45 million households in America are home to at least one cat. That's according to research from the University of Arizona. We explore the language of cats and how they have learned to communicate their needs and their wants through millennia. Call in with a question or comments, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Sarah Brown is a cat behavior scientist. Her new book is called The Hidden Language of Cats, How They Have Us at Meow. Sarah, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Hey, Kate. Thank you so much. Thanks for inviting me.
Yes, you say there are millions of feral cats in the world who live almost entirely without humans around them. How does our interaction, our human interaction, affect the behavior of cats?
Well, yes, there are millions of ferals, and the whole thing about cats being so amazing is that they can adapt to so many different environments. So they can live completely independent of people, as feral cats do in groups, in colonies. They can live, solitary lives as ferals, and then all the way through to, the cats we have in our homes, living, pampered, wonderful domestic lives with us. So, the interaction between people and cats is very profoundly different in different situations. So there's not a very quick answer to that question, but pick any one of those places and their relationship with people will be different.
You say how domestic cats, they originate from shy, solitary wild cats in North America, and these cats joined humans after they learned to talk to us. Why would ancient cats want to communicate with people?
Yes, so the relationship is thought to have begun back in North Africa about 10,000 years ago. And these were wild cats that would hang around the very early human communities that developed back then. When people started to change from hunter-gathering to growing crops, then settlements developed and little farming communities developed. And the wild cats would hang around these settlements because we stored grain, and these stores of grain began to attract rodents. And these rodents were what attracted the wild cats that were looking for food. And so they would hang around, and the farmers gradually realized that these wild cats were very useful as pest controllers, and so would have tolerated them. And over time, wild cats got used to being around people and being around each other, and gradually learned to communicate with one another and with people. And it's thought that this is the way that they gradually found their way into our homes. They crept over our doorsteps and sort of self-domesticated themselves.
So the cats kind of found job opportunities as rodent hunters.
Exactly. Yes, they were good at it. And they did it, they filled a niche when they were needed.
So dogs versus cats, we know that there is some strong feelings on both sides of that. The American Pet Products Association says cats are the second most popular pet in the country. Dogs are the most popular. How do cats and dogs communicate differently with people?
That's an interesting question. I think part of that relates to how more domesticated dogs probably are than cats. So We dogs have been around us for a lot longer than cats, and also dogs are descended from a social species. They come from wolves that were already social, and they had a whole repertoire of social signals to use already made, whereas cats come from a solitary ancestor, and so had a lot more work to do, if you like, to try and develop new signals that we would understand. So wild cats, for example, would communicate by scent, and that works great over long distance when you're not socializing up close, but it obviously doesn't work terribly well with humans. And so cats have had to learn new signals, tail signals, they rub around us, they meow at us, whereas dogs have much more obvious signals, I think, much more familiar signals to us. So, they use eye contact a lot more, and they're much more eager to please probably than cats. So they work very hard at communicating with us.
Sarah Brown is a cat behavior scientist, author of the new book, The Hidden Language of Cats. You can join in with your questions and comments about cat behavior, cat communication. The number is 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. You say cats owned as pets largely lack the typical qualities of domesticated animals, like selective breeding control and viewing people as their, quote, leader. How really domesticated are cats then? Sarah, can you hear us? I think we're having a connection issue here with Sarah Brown. Sarah, just wondering if our connection has failed with us across the pond. I think we're having some problem here. Sarah Brown, scientist of cat behavior, new book is called The Hidden Language of Cats. You can be part of this discussion about the lives of our feline companions. 800-642-1234. Sarah, can you hear us now?
I can. Sorry about that. If that was me.
That's okay. You know, how much control are cats in? I mean, how domesticated are they? Because you've talked about how they kind of, you know, selective breeding control, viewing people as their leader, maybe not so.
Yeah. So in some ways, I mean, they've changed a lot from behaviorally from their wildcat ancestor, in terms of their behavior, but physically they look a lot like their ancestors. So if you saw a wildcat, an African wildcat in your garden, it wouldn't look a whole lot different to the, you know, to a domestic cat in your garden. But behaviorally they've changed a lot, and that's where they've worked really hard, and that's where why I wrote this book, because I wanted to illustrate how hard they have worked at creating new ways of speaking to us. But other than that, the main reason they're not terribly domesticated is that they don't necessarily work well under controlled breeding circumstances. So people do breed cats, but most cats, the majority of cats in the world, just breed amongst themselves quite freely, you know, and not under the control of people. And that's why we have, you know, so many feral cats that grow up, you know, without any contact with people, because cats are so good at adapting to any place, and they will just breed, you know, amongst themselves without, they don't need us to breed. So yeah, that's the element of domestication that they lack, really.
You saw that independence firsthand, you know, when you looked at feral cats, you observed them in their environment, you know, many years ago. What did you take away from those observations going there every day? And I think it was the grounds of a hospital.
Yeah, so I studied two groups of feral cats, and one lived in the grounds of a big old hospital, like you say, and the other was a group that we rescued from the grounds of a school, and they were then neutered and relocated on a farm. And I watched these two colonies for a long time, and I used to go every day and watch them with my binoculars the old-fashioned way, and record everything they did, basically, to communicate with one another. And, you know, after all this time, I then analysed all the behaviours that I'd seen them do. And one of the most interesting behaviours they did use was the tail-up signal, which is when the cat walks up to another one and raises its tail into a vertical position. And I discovered that this, when one cat approached another with its tail up like this, it was very unlikely that any hostile behaviour would follow. So it was a sort of greeting behaviour, I come in peace sign, and and it would be followed by rubbing or other friendly behaviours. Whereas if it approached with its tail down, you know, very much more mixed bag of behaviors could follow. So, you know, they might be a bit aggressive or just less friendly. So this tail up signal was a really big, important part of cat society.
Oh, and that tail up etiquette, our cat does that to greet us. And there's even a little quiver.
Right.
There's a quiver in that tail up. What is Maddie saying to us?
I love the quiver. The quiver is like, oh, I'm really pleased to see you. And, you know, as you say, they use this same behavior to greet us, just as they would greet another cat. And yeah, the little trembling at the top is it just excitement, really?
Aww, I love it.
Yeah.
I love it. Sarah Brown with a scientist of cat behavior. Call in with a question. Share your thoughts. 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kedar Chirkant. A new book about our feline friends presents scientific evidence about how impressively cats have learned how to communicate both with each other and with us humans. Cat behaviorist Sarah Brown's book is called The Hidden Language of Cats. Be part of this discussion. Call in with a question. Share your experiences. 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Karen in Madison. Go ahead, Karen.
Hi there. Hi. I have a cat that I adopted when I was 7. And in her previous life, she had lived with a Chihuahua who was her best friend. And she has had adopted a lot of vocal patterns that seemed canine to me and play patterns. And I just discovered recently that she likes to be chased. And I'm just wondering how else I can learn to understand my cat.
Yes. Karen, thank you. Sarah, what has the cat picked up from the Chihuahua?
Yeah, that's really interesting because there's been studies, on cats and dogs living together, and the two species have, quite different signals in some circumstances. For example, a tail swishing behavior in a cat is a sign that it's not very happy, whereas obviously tail wagging in dogs is a happy signal. And similarly, cats like to greet each other, nose to nose, and dogs like to go the other end when they greet each other for a sniff. And so you see in houses that dogs, my own dog has done this, he's learnt finally to greet my own cat with his nose to nose rather than the other end, and they've studied animals to show that they can, these two species can learn each other's signals quite well. In fact, a lot better than we do a lot of the time. So it's amazing to hear these stories when a cat and a dog pick up, traits from other species within their household, particularly the sounds. I'm very interested in what sounds the cat makes that a dog like. That would be really interesting to hear.
Karen, what are those sounds?
She actually kind of barks a meow. It's more like meow, meow.
I wonder if the Chihuahua used to bark back. That'd be interesting, wouldn't it? It's lovely. Just encourage her to express herself and talk to your cat as much as you can is what I'd say, because I think developing that communication with your cat is great, whether it's dog talk or human talk or whatever.
Karen, thank you so much for contributing. Jessica now in Eau Claire. Jessica, hi, go ahead.
Hi, thanks for taking my question. I work for a local animal shelter, and we do not have the ability to do trap, neuter, release, and we get a lot of barn cats in. And I was just wondering, how old does a cat, or how young to domesticate them, essentially? Like, is there an age where, it's hopeless and we're not going to be able to make them into house cats?
Yes, so that's a very good question. And early studies showed that sadly, the socialization period for a kitten is really early on in life. So the period between 2 and 7 weeks old is that time when they need to get handled by people and meet people and, just generally be around people in order to grow up to be comfortable and friendly towards people later in life. So 2 to 7 weeks is when it kind of has to start. So it doesn't have to, it doesn't have to all happen within that. So say, you've got a feral kitten that you pick up at around 7 weeks, that's not too late to start the process. And that's just a general sort of rule. There's always exceptions. So I've met feral kittens of 11, 12 weeks that are sort of, just on the edge of, is it too late to socialize them? And you know, they can be brought round. It's often a lot harder and a lot longer of a process to try and socialize them. But generally speaking, 2 to 7 weeks is the period in which they need to have some sort of exposure to people in order to, you know, to turn them into a sort of socialized cat.
What if they're no longer kittens?
Yeah, that's tricky. And as the caller will probably confirm, it's difficult. The people do spend a lot of time, you know, one-to-one on feral cats and try and bring them round. And sometimes it's possible to make them more friendly. Even the cats that I studied, the ferals that I studied outdoors, they never became, you know, or to say sort of friendly or very tame to me, but they would get nearer and nearer to me as time went on and sit closer to me and tolerate me. So that's often the best you can do with the feral. And in those cases, it's best to find them a home, you know, not inside a human home, but a farm home or a barn home or somewhere where they have more freedom.
I picked up that when choosing a kitten, you called it something of a lottery in the kitten's temperament and their personality. Why is that?
Yeah, it's very hard to tell because kittens are cute, right? All kittens are cute.
Absolutely, yes.
And you might get the odd one that doesn't look quite so friendly, but generally speaking, most of them, you know, in a domestic litter situation, will all look quite cute and friendly. So it's hard to tell exactly how they're going to turn out later in life, but there are ways. Obviously, what I just said, that whether you can find out how much it's been handled in that 2 to 7 week period is the most important thing for how friendly it will be later in life. So finding out, you know, what it's experienced in the first 2 months of its life is very important.
What if the mother cat has had a lot of that socialization, has been part of a family? Does any of that translate over to the kittens, that trust?
Yes, it does. And that's what I was going to say. So obviously the parents put in some genetic input into the kids' personality. And the mother's is often very much reflected in how she behaves around people. So, you know, if she's a friendly mother, then she will encourage her kittens to interact with people. But also the father, if you know the personality of the father, that's a really interesting thing about the father is that kittens inherit how bold they're going to be from their father, and studies have shown that like a bold male cat will produce bold kittens, whereas a shy male cat will produce shy kittens. And those kittens can still be socialized and brought around and made more friendly if they get that socialization, you know, when I say between 2 and 7 weeks. But yeah, the parents do have a big input, but so does their environment. You know, how much attention and, you know, how many household things they're exposed to as they're growing up as kittens.
Sarah Brown, author of the new book called The Hidden Language of Cats. Your questions and comments along the way at 800-642-1234. Sarah, how does indoor life affect a cat's health when they only stay indoors?
Well, behaviorally, obviously indoor life is very different to an outdoor life for a cat. Mm-hmm. And that's fine as long as they get plenty of enrichment indoors. So you're trying to replace, you know, stimulation that they would have had outdoors. You need to try and replace that somehow indoors. So enrichment means things like scratching posts, places to climb, places to hide, lots of things to play with, lots of toys, puzzle feeders, things like that. Anything that makes life a bit more interesting and a bit more of a challenge. So, you know, not just just a general bowl of food, but, you know, scatter feeding their food or, you know, like I say, puzzle feeders, places to go up high. They like to, you know, that you can sort of extend their range of places to visit by giving them places to hide, you know, on top of the wardrobe or shelves or cardboard boxes, all sorts of things, and just as much enrichment as you can find to change their daily life and their daily routine.
They also
and play with your cat.
Yeah, when you're talking about climbing, I mean, they'll certainly climb the upholstery and the couch in places you don't want them. You know, what is the scratching about?
Yeah, so scratching is one scratching is a fascinating behavior because it's so important for cats to scratch, and it has so many different functions. And the one that we always think of is the more obvious one of keeping their claws healthy by, removing the outer husks of their claws. And that's when they scratch on our couch and we think, well, it's so annoying. But actually it's scratching is a very important social signal for cats because they have these scent glands between their toes called the interdigital scent glands. And so when they scratch, they leave scent marks on the surface that they're scratching. And this is a really important social signal. And also those scratch marks are actually a really important visual signal for cats. They actually see the scratch marks, which we hate.
And we're going to pause right there with Sarah Brown, Studies Cats. You can call in 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. It's The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're in conversation with cat behavior scientist Sarah Brown, whose new book explores the domesticated cat's journey of ups and downs into our Wisconsin homes. And you can be part of the conversation. Email what's on your mind about feline companions, ideas at WPR.org. Let's go to Jay in Madison. Jay, hi. What is your question? Hi, Jay. Can you hear us?
Hi.
Yes, go ahead. Yes.
I have a 4-year-old silver tabby who I adopted from a shelter, and he must have been food deprived somewhere along the line because he's insatiable, always wanting food and calling loudly for it. I've been giving in to him too often, I feel, because he's put on a little too much weight now. And he also is somewhat aggressive to our other cat, who we've had for now 8 years. And so I'd like to know how to do two things. Get him satisfied with the amount of food that we'd prefer to ration so he doesn't put on too much weight, and then the aggressiveness that he tends to show.
Thank you, Jay. Sarah, go ahead.
Yeah, well, it's a very complicated question. I think one of the first things I'd say is that, maybe just to get him checked out by a vet, if that hasn't already happened, just to check the weight situation and the hunger situation, that there isn't some kind of medical problem going on, that he is so hungry all the time. And assuming that that's all okay, there's obviously some element of competition going on between the cats for food. So I would always say, even if there isn't competition, that you should feed cats separately so that they're not fed in the same place at the same, maybe at the same time, but not in the same place, so that your other cat doesn't feel sort of terrorized or frightened to eat or having to eat very fast in order to get his ration or her ration. With your cat that's very hungry all the time, one idea is to try and not provide the food all in one go. So for a meal, separate the cat from the other cat and do some scatter feeding or hide the food. If it's dry food particularly, you can do all sorts of games with puzzle feeders and make it work a little bit more for its food. And that's a way of the cat getting some exercise while also moderating the amount and quantity of the food at the same time as entertaining them a bit and taking the focus off quantity and constant food. Make it more of a game is what I would suggest, but maybe get it checked out too, just to make sure there's not a medical issue is what I'd say.
How much stress can be introduced when you do have two cats in the home? What might that feel like for the cats?
Yeah, that's a very interesting question, and it varies so much. So the cat you know, is innately a solitary species. It comes from a solitary ancestor. And that said, domestication has equipped them with the ability to live alongside other cats very well when necessary. But some cats are better at this than others. So it's best to think very carefully about you know, having two cats and how you introduce them if you're going to have two cats. If you know, that process should be done very slowly and carefully. But once you have got two cats in a home together, it's very important that they have enough resources. By resources, I mean litter boxes, food, places to sleep, enough of these resources to live separately if they need to, if that makes any sense, so that they have different areas of the house where they have something that they need. So they, you know, a litter box each and hopefully an extra one somewhere else in the house, so they don't have to compete for the litter box. Because sometimes competition is very subtle between cats. So one might be very subtly bullying another one and you would never know. They might just sit near the litter box when the other one needs it, or you know, sit near a cat door, or all sorts of strange things go on that are probably not very obvious to, you know, to the casual observer. And so just providing enough space or resources is very important, so that they can separate their lives and live, you know, timeshare a house if they need to.
I thought it was so interesting how you said adopting cats even from the, or kittens from the same litter, in the end, they may not get along. You just assume cats, kittens from the same litter would get along.
Yeah, very much so. And I actually have two cats that did exactly that. They were the best of friends. And, you know, how could they ever not love each other, you thought, when they were, you know, sitting in your lap together. But as time went on, and as time does go on, sometimes they don't see eye to eye, just like with people sometimes. And, you know, and that's a situation where just providing enough resources, you know, enough beds so that they can clear off and go, and one can sleep in one bed and one can sleep in another, it is very important, so they can, you know, they can both happily exist but not necessarily be in the same social group as what we say when they, you know, so like if they, sometimes you see cats that are very bonded and they curl up together, and we would describe them as very much in the same social group, and they love each other very much. But, you know, sadly it doesn't always happen, but they do learn to tolerate one another quite well if you provide enough things for them.
Sarah Brown, author of the new book called The Hidden Language of Cats. Let's go to Missy in La Crosse. Missy, hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my question. I had about 6 months ago, there was a cat that started to appear at nighttime on my Ring doorbell. And I've just been noticing that it's been out late at night and doesn't have a collar. And I've never had a cat. I don't know much about cats. And I just wondered, you know, I've started to become a little concerned about, like, oh, it's getting cold out. And is there something as a homeowner I should be doing to, you know, aid in the cat or help it or just leave it alone? Do you guys have any thoughts about, I guess, number one, are cats able to survive out in winter in Wisconsin and be okay? Or do you have any tips on what homeowners can do if they find a cat around their house? Because it seems very friendly and it seems like it wants to come in and I don't know what to do.
Have you fed it at all, Missy? Have you given it food?
No, we haven't.
Okay, Sarah, go ahead.
So yes, this is another very interesting one, and often, you know, a very common occurrence, sadly, because, you know, it's hard to tell when a cat turns up on your doorstep. So is this cat, you know, a stray? Is it hungry, or is it actually just like my cat, what we call a six dinner Sid, who wanders around the neighborhood getting lunch and dinner at every house it can and then returning home quite contentedly? But it sounds like if it's happening in the middle of the night, that perhaps the cat, you know, it might be a stray. You don't say whether it looks thin or whether it looks a bit bedraggled. That's often a good way of telling whether it's, you know, it's cared for, you know, whether it's really actually an owned cat. It's you could possibly put posters up around the neighborhood saying, you know, is this cat yours? One thing we do in the UK sometimes for cats like this, outdoor cats, is if you can touch it, if it lets you touch it, you can put a little paper collar around it saying, is this your cat? please, you know, call me on this number if it is. And then that way, you know, if the owner, if it then goes back to its owner and the owner can see it's visiting other people, it can, the owner can make it evident to those people that it's their cat and they don't need to be adopted. Because the danger is, as you've sort of indicated, that if you start to feed the cat, that the cat will then come more and more. And that can sometimes be okay, but sometimes it's not okay if, you know, if the cat's on a special diet or, you know, for whatever reason. I would go for the posters or the collar, or just ask the neighbors. Have you asked around next door and, you know, opposite and up and down the street whether anybody knows whose cat this is? If, you know, if it becomes a long-term problem, you could catch the cat, take it to a vet, and the vet will scan the cat for a microchip to see if it's got see if it's registered with anyone, because most cats these days have a chip when they're owned, and that's a good way of tracing the owner.
Can you talk about the scent with how cats smell, and because it's such a major part of a cat's life, why is smell so important for cats?
Yeah, it's hugely important, partly because they started off solitary and that was their go-to way of communicating. So they would leave scent marks for other cats to smell later. And then that way they didn't have to ever, you know, encounter one another and have awkward encounters face to face. And they have such an impressive sense of smell. They have two methods of smelling. They have, you know, their noses just like us, but they have this extra organ of smell in the roof of their mouth called a vomeronasal organ, or VNO, which they also use to smell these social smells that other cats and other animals will leave. They spend a lot of time smelling things and leaving scents that we can't smell or that we don't try and smell that we don't know about. Like when they rub on us, that's scent marking, or when they rub on an object, you might see if the cat in your home rubs on the edge of a doorway, they'll leave a little dark smudgy mark eventually, which is sort of waxy secretion from their from the glands around their mouth. And like I said before, a scratching, even that leaves a scent mark. So everything around them is scent based.
Let's go to Edward in Maguanago. Edward, hi.
Hi, how are you?
Good. What would you like to bring up?
Well, thanks for taking my call. I have a feral cat. Well, he was feral. He's about 5 years old. Found him on our farm, and we've since moved. But he was very friendly from the get-go, so I think he had been around people earlier. Long story short, we domesticated him. I had him neutered. And I have, well, we have a total of 6 cats. And so a lot of them are young, his age. He's very playful with most of them. But my girlfriend moved in with her cat, who is a female and about 4 years old, and she's also spayed. And they were okay in the beginning, but he started to target her. And it got to the point where he would seek her out and was so aggressive when he would attack her, like we would have to physically separate him. We'd get cut up. And so now we've been at this point for almost 2 years now where one of the cats is in our bedroom during the day and then we switch them out, you know, in the afternoon. And that's the only way that they can coexist because they see each other. She growls and then, you know, starts the startle response and runs and he chases her. And it's very scary because he's such a friendly cat, but when he sees her, his demeanor completely changed. Wow. We tried pheromone collars, direct supervision, playing with them in the same area. They used to eat in the same place and, you know, supervised, but the thing we haven't tried is medication. So I'm just wondering, like, any thoughts on all of that?
Wow. Edward, thank you for sharing. Sarah.
Well, that's such a shame. Do you have any idea, was there a sudden event that changed their relationship? Because it sounds like they got on okay at the start and then something pushed that a little bit.
No, it was just a slow and gradual, like, and I think it kind of, it grew because he would chase her and she would run. And she's playful with the other cats, but I think it just became a predatory prey.
So you think they both get along with all the other cats? They both get along with the other cats? It's not. Do they both get along with the other cats in your house, or is it split?
Yeah, and Camilla, her cat is kind of less social, but she's come around with some of the younger cats that she plays. The only other cat that Bob, the male that we're referring to, doesn't seem to get along with as much as my very old, like 17-year-old male cat. He will target him as well, but it's Thomas is old and he like doesn't run. He stands up to Bob, so it's a little different dynamic. Whereas Camilla will run.
Yeah, he sounds like quite a dominant cat. Does he go out at all? Do guys go outside, or are they indoor cats?
No, they're indoor. He would prefer to go outside, and he used to. He'll get out if he can, but we've limited that and stopped that for the most part.
Okay. Yeah, well, I think in the absence of any, it sounds like you've tried most of the methods that we try. You've tried gradually introducing each other's scent to them slowly, having separated them. Have you tried that? So you put one cat away from the other for a while so they don't have any contact, and then swap their scents over so something that smells of one cat goes in with the other, and then gradually increase this exposure of scent to each other, and then because scent is the first thing that they get used to with each other, and then supervised introductions. But you mentioned that already, so I assume that you've probably tried these methods. You could get a behaviorist in to actually go through your case bit by bit. It's very hard to do long distance when you can't see the whole setup at home. Yeah. But I just think you're gonna have to keep them separate for some long period of time until you can gradually try and introduce them to each other again slowly.
Kind of starting from scratch again, as if
starting from scratch. Yeah, yeah, literally. Is the way that we do. We go back to they've never met is how I would describe that process that we normally do. But it's very hard when you've got a lot of cats in the same situation.
Edward, thank you so much for calling in. Sarah Brown studies cat behavior. New book is called The Hidden Language of Cats. You can join in. Questions, share, comments, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It's The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We have cat behavior scientist Sarah Brown, our guide to the origins of today's domestic cats and their remarkable ability to adapt and live in almost any environment. Call in with a question, share your perspectives, 800-642-1234. We have Nancy in Prairie du Sac. Nancy, hi.
Hi there. I have a story to share. We have a nice feral cat. She's about 4 years old now. We live in the country, and early one spring, actually it was in 2019, I found a mother cat who was a feral cat lying alongside our shed. And then 2 weeks or so passed, and I saw this kitten skirting around the garden. And I thought maybe she was around 4 weeks old just by what size she was. And I noticed her climbing up this tree near our horse shelter. And I started to offer her food and then play with bale twines, things like that. And then finally, I was able to touch her. And I took her to Madison to have her spayed. And we kept her in a cage for 5 days. And about the same time, we had a puppy. And the kitten and the puppy became really good friends. And this puppy was taught by the kitten how to hunt mice and bunnies. My husband named the cat Hunter. Good idea, because that is what she is. So one day I saw her stalking a pine squirrel. You know how fast they are. Sometimes I find live bunnies running around my shed. She has to climb up a 5-foot chain link fence to get in and out of the shed, the barn, because we don't have a cat door, per se. And so that's what she does. And then she sleeps with our dog in his doghouse. And I might mention, we always had, because the dog and she are so close together, I have always given her monthly flea and tick ointment. And then she gets wormed twice a year. So this feral cat is is awesome, and I would be lost without her.
Oh, Nancy, thank you so much for sharing that story. Sarah, what stands out to you?
Yeah, that's a lovely story, and she sounds like the perfect example of a cat that's got a, you know, still kept her wild side from her mum, and you know, still keeps her wild roots, but still likes some of the home comforts of a home and a companion in the home, like the dog. That's lovely. I love that. It's a blend of different lives of cats.
I want to bring up our sweet cat, Maddie, who lost her ability to meow. She was diagnosed with tonsillitis earlier this year by the vet. How does losing the ability to communicate vocally affect a cat's behavior?
Is this your cat?
This is my cat, Maddie. Yes.
Oh my gosh.
No more meows in her life. Yes.
Well, I'd love to know how you have found that. Has it changed how you interact with her because she can't meow at you and get your attention? Does she use other methods to get your attention now?
Yeah, eye contact is huge.
Eye contact. Rubbing? Does she rub around you more, perhaps?
Rubbing, and then if she really wants my attention, she initiates the slow blink.
Lovely. Love that.
I mean, we have been slow blinking with her since she was little, but if she really wants to just melt our heart, she'll slow blink first. Can you talk about what that is communicating?
So slow blinking is for people that don't know, it's hard to demonstrate on the radio, but it's where you slightly narrow your eyes, half close them and then open them again. And cats do this too. And so if you find yourself looking at a cat for maybe a little bit too long and you think, well, now what do we do? If you do this sort of squinty slow blink, they quite often do it back. And it's an indication that they feel comfortable, that they're, you know, they're comfortable with that situation, puts them at their ease. And like I say, they will often reciprocate it if you do it. And it's just a way of breaking the ice, if you like, sometimes between you and a cat. So, yeah, it's a lovely way of connecting with your cat. Try it at home.
We have less than a minute left. How could communication between cats and people, cats and their owners, potentially evolve in the future?
Well, that's a great question. And I think how I want it to evolve is that would love for people to just watch their cats more, take a closer look at their cats in their lives and think about what their cat is seeing and smelling and hearing and how best they can, you know, you can interact with them, because I think there's so much more for us to explore with our cats that we're missing out on at the moment, you know, that we perhaps we have with our dogs that we don't do with our cats. So I think the world is our oyster in terms of what we can say to each other with our cats.
I love that. And, you know, also I have constant communication with I'm always talking with the cat. Like, I'll be reading your book and then I'll tell our cat Maddie what I learned. You know, is that type of communication effective, do you think?
Oh, very much so. Yeah. Uh-huh. And that's how, you know, cats will meow and we talk back to them in a similar, you know, high pitched voice quite often. And these dialogues develop between ourselves and our pets, and that's how our relationships, you know, develop. It's brilliant.
Oh, Sarah, what a pleasure. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me. It's been great fun.
Sarah Brown, independent cat behavior scientist. New book is called The Hidden Language of Cats, How They Have Us at Meow. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Milwaukee is the oldest school voucher program in America. We dive into the history of school choice and how it's become a partisan issue as more public dollars flow to private schools. You can be part of the discussion, calling in with a question, sharing your thoughts, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Kara Fitzpatrick is a story editor for the news outlet Chalkbeat. Her new book is called The Death of Public School, How Conservatives Won the War Over Education in America. Kara, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So setting the scene here, voucher schools are private schools that use taxpayer dollars to subsidize the education of students from lower-income families. Wisconsin having four state-run, state-funded programs, including the Milwaukee Parental Choice Program. To what degree is Milwaukee the model for voucher programs in America?
Well, Milwaukee was the first in 1990, and it sort of set up the idea that these programs were targeted for specific groups, you know, primarily low-income children. And that was the model for decades. And now that started to change. You know, we're starting to see this push for universal vouchers where everyone, regardless of income, qualifies.
You talked about how Milwaukee was the perfect moment, the perfect city to launch a voucher program. What were the dynamics in Milwaukee that made it that environment?
Yeah, it's interesting because Milwaukee really was a place that almost seemed set up for this, because you had at the time, you know, concerns, pretty deep concerns, particularly in the Black community, about the quality of education that Black students were receiving in Milwaukee. You also had this history of independent private schools in Milwaukee that had a reputation for providing a quality education to Black students, to Latino students, you know, to low-income students. And so you already had that in the city. You know, those schools already existed and people respected that education that the kids there were receiving. And then you also had, you know, this dynamic of having Polly Williams, who was a state representative, who was deeply interested in education and was very concerned about how Black students were doing. And it was this moment in time where I think people were looking for solutions to some of the problems in the school system. And school vouchers was one of the things that people started talking about.
And just noting here, State Representative Polly Williams in Wisconsin's legislature at that time, you know, you made a point of writing about former Education Secretary Betsy DeVos labeling America's public education system as racist in her book. What is the significance of a prominent conservative framing public schools this way?
Yeah, I thought that was sort of interesting, especially at this moment in time where you see Republicans really trying to, in a lot of states, really trying to control how teachers are talking about race and racism and that history in our country. And so I thought it was sort of interesting that Betsy DeVos would characterize the public school system as one of the only institutions in America as being racist, as opposed to any number of other institutions in America. And it's it sort of feeds into this idea that you need to give students a way out of the school system. And it's part of this history of referring to school choice as this civil rights issue that conservatives have done for a long time.
Yeah, I mean, how has the school choice movement attached itself to the civil rights movement, especially in the litigation?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting because there was disagreement, you know, there's disagreement within the movement about whether or not you really should do that, whether you should attach school choice to the civil rights movement and say that this is a civil rights issue. And there are some prominent voices within the movement who disagreed with that, who thought that school choice had to stand on its own. But it really took off, you know, conservatives used that idea really pretty prominently. You know, you had the president saying so, you had the education secretary saying so. And in the litigation, in the court case that finally the U.S. Supreme Court said, yes, it was actually Cleveland's program, but yes, Cleveland's school vouchers can stand. We can have school voucher programs within certain parameters. And that was a key part of that litigation, that the side that was for school choice was saying, this isn't about sending tax dollars to religious schools. You know, this is about civil rights, and this is about giving educational opportunities, particularly to students of color.
We're talking about, I'm sorry.
Go ahead. I was just going to say that was a really winning argument.
We're talking about the history of school choice, the rise of the voucher program in Milwaukee. Kara Fitzpatrick is the author of the book, The Death of Public School. You can join the conversation calling in with a question or comments, 800-642-1234. Let's turn to Mike in St. Lawrence. Mike, hi. What comes up for you?
Good morning. Yeah, I called in the last time you had a show on 2 or 3 months ago, and I asked the same question. Basically, is how much of the Wisconsin taxpayers' dollars or the city of Milwaukee taxpayers' dollars go to support the church structure as opposed, I don't know, I guess they get so much per pupil, but how much of that money actually sticks with the pupil rather than doing other things in the church?
Mike, thank you for that question. Kara, what have you found through your research?
You know, I don't know dollar figures off the top of my head, but the way that the program works, at least in Milwaukee, is that the voucher pays for tuition. So how much of that ends up going to support, you know, how the school decides to use that money is up to them, essentially. You know, there's not, to my knowledge, a lot of control around that, but it's most likely just paying for tuition. You know, it's not necessarily supporting church functions outside of that religious education that someone might be receiving if it's going to a religious school, which many of them are.
There was also, you talked about in your book, the Lemon Test, and you know, court ruled that it was unconstitutional for a state to supplement the salaries of religious school teachers, and maybe that too perhaps probes a little bit into Mike's question about, you know, to what extent do these dollars flow to other things beyond that student's education?
I think you were the first person to ask me about the Lemon Test. I love it. You know, it's interesting because it's one of the questions that is throughout the entire legal history, you know, and early on, before Milwaukee's program, very early on, the Supreme Court was sort of wrestling with this idea of church-state separation, which is actually a little bit murkier. It's a murkier area of law than really I realized when I started the research. But it was kind of this issue of how much is this money supporting or advancing religion, and how much is really, you know, just providing this sort of secular function of giving a child an education. And over time, you know, over decades, really, the court has gone more and more in the direction of supporting programs like this. And, you know, and saying that as long as this is serving this function of providing education, then it's really okay. And also, if the money is getting there because parents are choosing that, then it's not the same as the government just giving money to a church. Hmm.
Education editor Kara Fitzpatrick traces the history of school choice in Wisconsin and in other states, the rise of public dollars following a child to their preferred educational option. And the book is called The Death of Public School. You can be part of the conversation. Call in with a question. Share your views. 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We examine the struggle over what constitutes public education and the rise of school vouchers in Milwaukee decades ago. Author Kara Fitzpatrick cites that more than half of states in the country now have publicly funded private school options. Her book is called The Death of Public School. You can join the discussion at any point. Call in with a question or add comments, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Kara, Reverend Virgil Bloom, the political science professor at Marquette University in the 50s, you give us a fuller picture of Bloom in the book. And he published a book in 58 calling for state aid to religious schools. What are Bloom's main arguments?
So Bloom is an interesting figure, and I think he's a lesser known figure in this history, but he really was making a case actually decades before a lot of people were, that this was an issue of religious liberty. And we've seen now in the last few years, the U.S. Supreme Court really under Roberts, you know, under Chief Justice John Roberts, go in this direction of talking more and more about religious liberty. But Bloom was making that argument in the 50s and 60s. And he was saying essentially that it was unfair, it was discrimination against religious families if they would be paying both taxes to support the public school system and also then, you know, in some cases maybe be struggling to pay tuition at, you know, say a Catholic school because that supported their values. And he really thought that if something was a public benefit, and he viewed education as a public benefit, then a religious education was serving much the same function, you know, that a public, traditional public education was. And so he thought that that was an issue of discrimination. And he really, you know, he really pushed for not just Catholics, but for all religious families to have some support, you know, taxpayer support for their education.
But in order to receive more financial support from the government, what were his thoughts on accountability to the public and how these school, how these children would be taught?
You know, it's interesting because Bloom really actually thought that in order to receive public dollars, that there should be some accountability. And he was somewhat different and maybe, again, ahead of his time in that respect. But he thought that, you know, if, say, a Catholic school was going to be receiving public dollars, that they should be open to, you know, financial audit and, you know, that perhaps they even needed to have sort of a similar, like an elected school board kind of idea, but for the Catholic school. And that, you know, that was something that made other supporters uncomfortable, having sort of that level of, they would say, government intrusion. And but he really thought that that was important if you were going to receive public dollars.
He also complained Catholics weren't taking advantage of their power as a voting bloc. What role did Catholics take as advocates for private school and what they had built through their schools?
Yeah, Bloom was sort of like delightfully cranky, I would say, in this respect. You know, he really was frustrated that Catholics weren't acting as a group, you know, and he really thought that if they did, they would have political power. But he sort of overlooked in a way the fact that not all Catholics actually agreed with the idea of vouchers, and some Catholics actually didn't want to open up their schools to have any kind of, you know, government involvement. That made them uncomfortable. And so there wasn't, I think, the widespread agreement that he really hoped for, you know, and so that was a point of frustration for him for basically his entire life.
Kara Fitzpatrick, author of The Death of Public Schools. We look at the history of school choice. You can join in 800-642-1234 with your questions and comments. Let's bring in Tim in Wausau now. Tim, hi.
Good morning. Thank you for the program and the discussion presented today.
You're welcome. Go ahead.
Question. Well, and first to an earlier caller's comment, in 2021, I believe it was, the Wisconsin budget was at about $90 billion, and 12 of it went to public schools. In that year, that, to the caller's question, about $350 million went to vouchers that went straight from people, taxpayers throughout the state of Wisconsin. And some estimates have that up to over $400 million because of other subsidies, if you will. Mm. So anyways, just to kind of help with that one. But question, what do you think was the watershed moment that went from a trickle of vouchers to the voucher in every backpack? And I'll sign off and thank you again for the conversation.
Tim, thanks. Kara, what was that watershed moment for more and more voucher?
Well, thanks first for adding the information. I appreciate that. You know, I think right now, when we're seeing this massive push for school choice and very successful push for school choice, I think a lot of it just relates back to the pandemic. In this moment, you know, there have been earlier moments where there was a good amount of legislation passed, but this has really been kind of a historic wave. And a lot of that really is to do with the pandemic just causing a certain amount of frustration with some of the choices that some public school districts made around closing and remote learning. And then also, I think that families, in that moment saw a lot of opportunities and tried different things, you know, that maybe they wouldn't have absent the pandemic.
Hmm. And just to note here, your book examines the history of school choice before the onset of the pandemic. And I guess if you could write additional chapters, what, you know, how transformational has the pandemic been on families looking for alternatives and then for the rise of other types of schooling?
Yeah, you know, I was writing the book during the pandemic, so it was sort of, it was hard to know exactly where it was going to go. And the legislation was passing at such a, you know, being proposed and then a lot of it passing at such a rapid rate, even as I was like editing the book, it was kind of crazy. But one of the big changes, you know, one of the largest shifts I've seen in the last few years with the pandemic is this rise of education savings accounts, which are even more flexible than vouchers. And it's basically, it's a sort of a limited use savings account where taxpayer dollars go into that account, and a family who withdraws from public school, you know, or actually it didn't go there in the first place, but a family can use that money in a lot of different ways. So you could still pay tuition, but you could also maybe pay for transportation. In some states, you can actually pay for homeschooling costs. You can pay for therapies, you know, perhaps if your child has a disability and needs like occupational or speech therapy, something along those lines. And so that is really a surprising sort of development, you know, and I think we're up to 9 states now that have universal ESAs where every kid qualifies.
Let's go to Jack in Madison. Jack, hi.
Hi there. I think it's very interesting because one of the thoughts that came to mind when I was thinking about the notion of school choice is the word choice, and it reminded me of the abortion debate, which is, you know, pro-choice versus pro-life nominally, and yet I think the stances here seem to be vice versa. And thinking about this notion of, like, this divide between funds going to school vouchers versus just funds going straight to public schools, and I wonder how we can sort of change the culture in a way, if you will, from being this divide between school vouchers versus public education and just work to unify the public at large around public education and work to make that the default model of education for children in various states.
Jack, thanks for that. Kara, go ahead. What insights do you have there? And, you know, also the terminology of vouchers having baggage itself.
Yeah, the terminology is something that's really interesting. And I get so sort of wrapped up in my world of school choice that I refer to things as choice. And then you run into people who have different ideas of what we're talking about. But it's interesting because, you know, just as a small note, one of the reasons that advocates of school choice often frame it around choice and scholarships and some of these words as opposed to vouchers is that it actually has, over time, it's polled better. People like the idea of choice. It's a very appealing concept, and they like the idea of vouchers a little less. So it's just an interesting note on the terminology. But, you know, I think as far as the public school system being the default, that is still the case. You know, it is still the case that the majority of American kids are going to public schools. And if you include charters in that, that's a pretty high percentage of kids. But I don't, you know, I kind of went searching for a middle ground in this, and there isn't much of one. We're in such a polarizing moment in politics right now and in our country right now that there's not much middle ground. So I don't know if I can be super helpful as far as finding one.
You know, in terms of that terminology, I mean, you found states that are using words like scholarships instead of vouchers or tuition grants. So I think that's really interesting as well as the language plays out around voucher programs. Kara Fitzpatrick examining experiments with school vouchers and the evolution of school choice in Wisconsin and across the nation in her new book. You can be part of this discussion about education. Call in with a question. You can share your perspectives. The number is 800-642-1234. Email ideas@wpr.org. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We explore America's debate over school choice and how school vouchers and charter schools have changed the educational landscape in Milwaukee and other cities. The new book is called The Death of Public School. You can take part in this conversation. Call in with a question. Add your thoughts. 800-642-1234. Email ideas@wpr.org. Author and journalist Kara Fitzpatrick stays with us. Kara, let's shine a light on Polly Williams, Democratic state lawmaker from Milwaukee who served for 30 years. In 1987, Williams approaches Republican Governor Tommy Thompson to propose this new school district made up of predominantly black schools in Milwaukee's, quote, inner core. Why was there this push for this school district?
Well, so it was not just Polly Williams. It was also Howard Fuller, you know, who went on to become a superintendent of Milwaukee Public Schools and is a pretty well-known school choice supporter there. But there was this idea that, you know, the school system was essentially, you know, in their view, failing black students. And because of a history of segregation and segregated schools in Milwaukee, you already had a part of the city where a number of schools were predominantly black. And so Polly Williams and Howard Fuller sort of pushed this idea that you could carve out a piece of the city school district and essentially turn it into an all-black school district, and that this would give those families a level of control and choice in their education that Polly and Howard Fuller thought was missing from the existing system. And it was an idea that was very controversial. You know, it was not supported by the NAACP.
They called it urban apartheid?
Yes, yes. I mean, because when you're talking about creating an all-black school district, in a lot of people's minds, you're going back to days of Jim Crow. You're going back to this idea of segregated schooling, which, you know, we know to be harmful to children. And so it was very controversial. And I think that it really wasn't going to go anywhere, but it did raise some attention to this idea of, well, how are black students doing in Milwaukee public schools?
So Polly Williams and Republican Governor Tommy Thompson, you know, they align. Thompson gains enough support to pass a limited school voucher plan for Milwaukee. How does Thompson gather support to pass this plan in a legislature that was controlled by Democrats at the time?
Well, you know, he tried. Tommy Thompson was interested in school vouchers actually before Polly Williams kind of came into that idea. And he tried to pass a voucher plan a couple times before and wasn't successful. I mean, just not didn't go anywhere at all. Mm-hmm. And so it really wasn't until Polly Williams kind of came into that idea and joined forces with him and really brought a lot of the black community in Milwaukee along that gained any traction. And I think part of the success of that was that it was a very small, you know, it was meant to be a very small program. It was in one city, you know, it had some of this grassroots community support. And so that gave it enough of a push that you could bring along enough Democrats to pass it and then had, you know, fairly widespread Republican support.
In 1995, Governor Tommy Thompson aims to expand the Milwaukee school voucher program to include religious schools. And he says school choice is about, quote, education serving the public. And you say that this statement, this word choice is important. What did you find there?
This is an idea that I thought was really interesting that you see a lot today and a little bit less so at the time, but it's this idea of sort of what is public education. You know, we think of a public school traditionally as what you see in cities all across the country, but a school that's secular, that's tuition free, that's essentially open to everyone and generally has some boundaries, you know, some zone issues there. And what Thompson was kind of talking about and what has become really a Republican viewpoint over time is this idea that any education paid for with the support of tax dollars is education in the public interest, and therefore it is also public education, and that could include religious education. And so that's a really different take on what public education is.
How did Polly Williams feel about that?
You know, I think Polly Williams was interested in school choice for a very particular reason. You know, she saw it as a tool of empowerment, you know, that school vouchers in particular were a tool of empowerment for low-income children. And, you know, her particular interest really was in students of color and providing more opportunities for kids who didn't have the ability to choose because maybe they weren't wealthy enough or they couldn't move, you know, some of the things that affluent families do. And so she wasn't really about this sort of larger conservative push for state aid to private education. She was really about kind of this more progressive view, you might say, of school vouchers as empowering particular groups of students.
We're talking about the history of school choice. Kara Fitzpatrick, author of The Death of Public School. You can join in along the way with a question, comments, 800-642-1234. Let's bring in Colleen in Darlington now. Colleen, hi.
Hi.
What would you like to bring up?
Well, my question is, how come I believe there's been two schools in Milwaukee, I don't know, their vouchers, charters, you know, closed in the middle of the night, no warning to the parents or everything, and they have no accountability? I mean, if that happened in a public school, God, the chaos would just be, the outrage would be unbelievable.
Colleen, thanks for calling in. Kara, what about the collapses of some schools? What did you find there?
Yeah, you know, this issue came up fairly early on with Milwaukee, where within the first few years, you had a couple of schools or a few schools, really, where they had financial problems or they had even fraud and abruptly closed. And so all of a sudden, these kids who are using vouchers to attend this school have to find somewhere else to go. And often they end up going back to the public system. And that issue, you know, that is throughout the school choice movement's history. That has happened in every place where they've had this. And it raises this kind of question of, you know, accountability, because if you're giving schools money and taxpayer dollars, and maybe they have shaky finances, or maybe they're not being run very well, and they close, and all of these kids are set adrift, you know, is this kind of a good use of taxpayer dollars? And that question has been there since the start.
It also, I think, speaks to, as you said, you know, some ballooning costs that you see in running parallel or multi different types of education for students that are supported in some way through the government. What do you see in this type of spending and what the future could hold?
Well, it's a difficult thing because you have a public school system that really is obligated to provide an education for any student who walks in the door. And when you have, you know, mechanisms where children can leave and choose other things year to year, and you don't know necessarily how many are going to come or go, it creates, you know, a certain amount of uncertainty in trying to plan for the public system. And that can result in, you know, small schools where you have the cost of maintaining this school. You know, you have to have a principal, and maybe you have to have an assistant principal, and you have to keep the lights on, and you have to have a bus, but, you know, half the kids leave. And so now the cost of running that school is much higher than it was. You know, there's that kind of dynamic to this where it's really hard for school districts to sort of sort out who they're going to be serving and how much money they're going to have. And it can change year to year.
Madeline from Green Bay called in. Madeline says most people don't realize that private schools do not have to accept children who have intellectual disabilities. And Madeline thinks private schools should be required to accept some percentage of these children. What did you find, you know, as you looked at who was being accepted into schools, especially, you know, children going into either charter schools or voucher programs?
Yeah, this is a big issue, you know, because some voucher programs are actually meant for students with disabilities, and some states, including Wisconsin, have programs for students with disabilities. But then, you know, parents who use those programs have to be aware that when they leave the public school system, they lose some of their rights. You know, if you go to a public school and your child has a disability, then by federal law, that child is entitled to certain services, and you go through a process of deciding what services the child is going to be provided. And, you know, there's a whole very involved process that a family can go through. When you leave the public school system, you know, because maybe it's not working for your child with disabilities, what you can run into is that the private schools don't have that same obligation to serve you. And so you have to really work to find a place that's going to support that child in the same way. And that can be really tricky.
Hmm. Education editor and author Kara Fitzpatrick's book traces the history of voucher programs and charter schools. We'll talk more about charters in a moment here. And also the birth of the voucher program in Milwaukee decades ago. You can be part of the discussion at any point. Call in with a question, share your thoughts. 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We learn about the future of American education as the line between public and private schools becomes increasingly blurred through school choice and Wisconsin's role in this history. Kara Fitzpatrick is author of The Death of Public School. Call in with a question, share comments, 800-642-1234. Kara, looking at charter schools now, we talked with the head of a Wisconsin nonprofit recently that supports charter schools, came on our program, said there isn't a stark difference between the academic performance of charter schools and other public schools in the state. This is Sarah Hackett.
When I look at Wisconsin data, I would say that there is not a ton that is going to make you say, aha, you know, like it's all like, oh, a little bit higher here, a little bit lower there, but nothing that's going to push either way off the map.
Kara, is this view in line with research on the effectiveness of charter schools?
Yeah, you know, it's interesting because at the start of this, charter schools started around the same time that vouchers did in sort of the modern era in 1991 in Minnesota. And there was kind of this open question as to whether or not they would be better. And now, you know, 30 some years later, we kind of have this answer that actually there's not a great deal of difference on average, in the performance of charter schools versus traditional public schools. There was just this last summer, a research study that came out of Credo, which is associated with Stanford. Mm-hmm. And that group has been studying charter schools basically since the start. And that was the first study from them that really said, okay, charter school students on average have a slight advantage in test scores, but it was incredibly small. I mean, you're talking about maybe the difference between the 50th percentile and like the 50.4. Mm-hmm. So just a very, very small difference.
Wisconsin is getting $58 million in federal grants to open or to and expand charter schools in our state. What is the federal government's role in driving change and in driving charter schools at K-12 schools?
Well, it's interesting because up until very recently, there was sort of a bipartisan consensus on charter schools that both Republicans and Democrats really supported charters. You know, and so you had George Bush as a supporter and Bill Clinton as an early supporter and Barack Obama, you know, and those administrations really were in favor of charters and helped, you know, helped sort of popularize the idea, but also provided some money. You know, there's the federal program that provides some money to help charters start. And then also during the Obama years, there was a program where states would apply for money. And part of that had to be, you know, that they were supporting some kind of innovation, and often it was charters.
You know, what would, you know, I'm just wondering the interplay between voucher programs and charter schools. I mean, would charter schools have taken off and been successful in Wisconsin and around the country, you know, as we saw the voucher programs expanding? Like, what's the interplay between those different programs?
This is one of the things that I was really kind of fascinated by in doing the research, was this idea that the charter school, in a way, actually becomes the more successful school choice reform mechanism, if you want to say that. You know, that a lot of Democrats, they essentially needed something to argue back against vouchers. And so charter schools kind of became that answer of, okay, well, we're in favor of choice, but we're in favor of public school choice, and we're in favor of charter schools, you know? And so it's interesting, because I think charter schools really took off because it had, the idea had fewer sort of legal questions. You didn't have this church state issue that came up so often with the vouchers. And it seemed a little clearer that a charter school probably was legal, where it wasn't as clear with a voucher. And so that idea really took off. And I think for Republicans, they were like, well, charter schools maybe aren't as great as vouchers, but it's still an idea that we can get behind.
Let's go to Tim now in New Berlin. Tim, hi. What would you like to share?
Yes, you were just saying that there's no significant difference between the voucher school performance and the public school performance. I would say that is not true. The public schools are significantly doing better because the public schools have to take everybody. I know of a classroom myself where there are three students in first grade who are in diapers. That is not because the parents didn't teach them, didn't potty train them. It's because through their own personal disabilities, that is because they have no choice, excuse the pun. What is going on is that for the public schools, considering that they have to take everybody with any mental or physical disability or violent behavior, the voucher schools do not have to do that. It is important to note that if there were a level playing field here, that if the voucher school programs were required to take these students, the public schools would be significantly outperforming the voucher schools.
Tim, thanks for calling in. Kara, can you give us more clarity on that, quote, playing field, if you will?
Yeah, well, I think just to clarify, we were talking about the difference between charter schools and traditional public schools. So if we want to talk about the difference between voucher schools and traditional public schools, there actually the research is worse. There's a number of recent studies of some of the major programs, you know, in Louisiana and in Ohio and in Washington, D.C., that really have shown that students who are using the vouchers actually perform worse on test scores. It can be about the same, and in many cases, it's worse, particularly in regards to math. So just to clarify that on the research front, the research around vouchers is not especially great academically. But on the playing field front, you know, I think that's a very fair comment and criticism, you know, because the public schools do have this obligation to take and serve every child. And so, you know, in some ways, when you're trying to compare these things, that in itself is a major difference. When they're doing the research around these programs, they typically are trying to compare the same types of children, you know, to be able to make those comparisons. And when they do, the vouchers have not shown to be this incredible improving force.
Lori now in Shawano. Lori, hi.
Hi. So it seems like religion is getting more and more into just the government. When is the government going to get into these schools and say, okay, you can't teach creationism, you have to teach evolution, you can't teach abstinence only, you got to teach reproductive health? If they're going to ban books, ban the Bible because it's full of violence and cruelty towards animals. I mean, there are schools that have been closed down, and I'm guessing it's because so much money is going towards these schools, these private schools.
Lori, I want Kara to jump in here on what is the role of teaching religion and reproductive health when it comes to voucher programs.
Well, so this is also one of the things that has always been controversial throughout the history, is that once programs started allowing religious schools to participate, it raised all of these questions about, you know, essentially what's being taught in some of those schools and whether or not it's okay to be giving public dollars to a school that maybe is teaching religious beliefs that conflict with scientific fact, for instance. And, you know, the way that the courts have come down on that is that it essentially is okay, you know, because it's the choice of the parents. And that's something that troubles a lot of people.
Your book ends in 2019, following a visit to Milwaukee by then Education Secretary Betsy DeVos. How much do conversations today about school choice stem from the influence of DeVos during the Trump administration in our last moments together?
Yeah, you know, Betsy DeVos is a longtime school choice supporter, and she was such a polarizing figure as education secretary that I think in some ways it actually harmed the choice movement. You know, you really kind of saw the bipartisanship around charter schools start to evaporate during that time when DeVos held that position. And so her role, you know, as a spokesperson was fairly huge to be in that job. But as in terms of what she actually accomplished, I think the lasting legacy there is really one of divisiveness.
Kara, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
Kara Fitzpatrick is author of The Death of Public School, How Conservatives Won the War Over Education in America, with book tour stops next week, by the way, in Madison at the Wisconsin Book Festival and Milwaukee at Marquette Law School. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network.